Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Friday, November 19th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my 47 years plus of doing therapy. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that particular chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to effectively turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on the link, download it, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process and or called in with powerful testimonials about how the actual application of the tool, just reading about it isn't enough, but the actual application of the tool has yielded positive benefits in their lives. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often. It frequently leads to comments or questions or testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, give us a call at 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1. It'll put a question mark by your phone number, and I will announce you by your area code. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 323rd day of the year. And today's lesson simply reads, I will gladly make the sacrifice, in quotes, sacrifice of fear. The only sacrifice we're asked to give, the only thing we're asked to give up in this work is fear. So it's really no sacrifice whatsoever, but in order to be in direct relationship with the truth of life and this wonderful creation that we're all being given the gift of experiencing, we need to be willing to let go of all of our illusions and hallucinations which generate fear. So here's the commentary from this lesson. Here, fear is the only sacrifice that the Creator asks of any of its offspring. The Creator asks us to give up all suffering, all sense of loss, all sadness, all anxiety and doubt, and freely let the Creator's love come streaming into our awareness. If we do that, it will heal us of pain, and it will give us access to that eternal joyous state. Such is the sacrifice you ask of us, Creator, and it's one we gladly make. The only cost of the restoration of the Creator's memory to us as offspring is giving up the fear, giving up the illusion of fear. And if we do this, it helps with the salvation of the world. And as we pay the debt we owe to truth, a debt that merely is letting go of self-deceptions, letting go of images that we worshipped that had no real substance. Capital T truth, what actually is, returns to us in wholeness and in joy. We cease to be deceived, and love, capital L love, the truth of life, the flow of creative energy, has now returned to our awareness, and we are at peace again. For the creation that we have made, this fear, is gone, and only the actual truth of life and love remains. So that's lesson 323, and from Pam Grout's book, The Course in Miracles Experiment, lesson 323 is titled, Lighten Up, Francis. She quotes a meme that popped up in her Facebook feed, and the meme says, stress doesn't really go with my outfit. Pam writes, today's lesson is provided by Bill Murray's sergeant in the movie Stripes. On the first night of boot camp, when members of Murray's platoon introduce themselves and a surly, uber-intense recruit stands up and announces, the name's Francis Sawyer, but everybody calls me Psycho. Any of you guys call me Francis, I'll kill you. Also, I don't like anybody touching me. Keep your meat hooks off. Anyone here ever tries to touch me, I'll kill you. At that point, Army Sergeant Hulka, played by Warren Oates, jumps in with this now famous line, lighten up, Francis. And that's what lesson 323 asks me to do. It asks me to close all those open tabs on my brain, to gladly sacrifice all the stress, the anxiety, all sense of loss and sadness. It asks me to take my meat hooks off self-deception and false images. In other words, it asks me to lighten up. So that's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson for today and the Course in Miracles experiment commentary from Pam Grout. And as usual, we've got about 15 minutes left to take your comments, your questions. 563-999-3581. What's on your mind? How can we support you today? It's been a rather up and down week, some monologues. I shared a worksheet that I did on Wednesday. I just finished a session with somebody that was struggling with the problem of, or the pattern of putting other people up on a pedestal and assuming that other people are smarter and healthier and have their act together more, and we were discussing what is the actual impact of that. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it right? Is it wrong? And I encouraged her to just observe rather than try to label that it's good or bad, right or wrong. Just watch what happens when she enters a situation with the assumption, with the belief, with the mode of operating that says, whoever's here, whoever's running this group, whoever's, you know, the owner of this building or restaurant or business must know more than me, must have their act together, etc. And how does that work out? What does it generate in me as a person when I start with those assumptions? And what does it generate in me if I walk in knowing, understanding everybody is just a person? Everybody's got their strong points and weak points. Everybody's got things that trigger them from time to time. Willingness to accept that I've been triggered is not a prerequisite for my getting triggered. I used to say about excuses, I used to say, an excuse doesn't have to be valid for me to use it. So this is in line with the Course in Miracles lesson, and so many of them that we've had, but including the lesson for today. We create these hallucinations, these fantasies of right, wrong, good, bad, we screwed up, we're terrible, everybody else is better than us, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm failing at this, I need to work harder at that, it's too late for me to succeed in life, et cetera, et cetera. I've wasted my life. We create all of those thoughts and all of the energies of negativity and sadness and fear and negative self-judgment that we generate when we grab those thoughts, when we hallucinate those things. They are not true. Yeah, in certain areas, certain people have a level of expertise about certain things that I don't. I wouldn't walk into a mechanic's shop and start telling them, you know, how to work on my car. At the same time, if I walk into the mechanic's shop and I had an appointment to be there at 8 in the morning and nobody's there to greet me and they don't come for a half an hour and or, you know, they're there and the shop's open but they're saying I didn't have an appointment when I've, you know, got the appointment in my hand, et cetera, I don't need to rage at them. I don't need to use the unproductive interaction patterns that I've learned from the not-so-healthy people in my life, in my family, or that I've downloaded from years of hanging around with people who were impatient. I don't need to jump into that based on the assumption that this is wrong and they should know better, etc. I can stay calm. I can actually operate after a nice deep breath, hold it at the top and slowly exhale. I can operate from the observation that, wow, the interpretation I'm placing on this interaction is triggering upset in me. And if this person seems to be upset because he or she says, I don't have an appointment and I have no right to be there, from the bird's eye view, from that 30,000-foot perspective, I can look down and see, oh, right here in this room, here are two human beings, each of them generating a negative emotional state and trying to blame the situation or the other person. So these two people are exactly the same. And I can embody that position and breathe and soften, maybe do some EFT tapping or the shortcut that has me rubbing my wrists or my fingers, and I can soften and gain a much more useful perspective before taking an action or making a statement, which, you know, if I do it from the negative perspective, it's just going to make the situation worse, not better. There is nobody in that situation that is better than me, worth more than me, knows more than me. There is not. There's just somebody else who's triggered to upset for from what's going on in their mind, how they've chosen to interpret and respond to the world in that moment. And there's me, who's been triggered to upset because of how I've chosen to interpret and respond to the world in that moment. And that's the core of our work, helping people understand that we, each one of us, is the author of our own emotional state and experience in any given moment. And I have the option to turn that emotional state into guidance and use it for my benefit, or I could use it as an excuse to engage in some destructive and unproductive behavior and blame it on somebody else. So that's why I presented the worksheet that I presented on Wednesday, because the more we are willing to say, wow, I'm stuck in the negative thought pattern, or wow, I keep generating a negative emotion about this. This is mine. This is my creation. What would I like to do with this creation? The more we do that, the more we step into the use of the tools, the less time we spend in the negative emotions, and the more productive and connected and respectful and harmonious are the interactions we have with our fellow travelers, our fellow human beings, our fellow beings of brilliance and light, who are either acting from the knowledge of their brilliance and their light, or they've either temporarily forgotten or they've yet to discover their brilliance. And yet, we're all the same. So, how can we support you today? We've got about 40 minutes left. Conversations, topics, suggestions for people to interview. I have another interview coming up after the show today with another functional medicine practitioner, hoping to get more people aware of the fact that there are many, many ways to look at a system, the whole system approach to things, and work to identify a cause for a physical, mental, or emotional pain or discomfort, rather than just medicating or in some other way temporarily alleviating the discomfort or the symptoms that someone might come in and ask for help with. And the more we can do that, both with physical and mental and emotional problems, the more we can alert people to the truth that there are so many good ways to start getting at cause rather than continually chasing after symptoms, the more it benefits everybody. And if that sounds interesting to you, there is a whole series of interviews with people, like-minded people, that are available on journeysdream.org website, and you can get access to the podcast there, journeysdream.org/podcast. And that's another thing we encourage people to take advantage of soon and often, because it's got some good material. It's got lots of, I think we've got 79 interviews that have been published. And it's a wonderful free resource. And it's a great way to just start exploring. And if you explore one or two podcasts, follow some of the links in the person's bio or the websites they're associated with, you might find something that's useful to you, or you might find something that's useful to a friend or a family member that's struggling with some mental health challenges. So, let us know how we can be of support to you today. What would you like to talk about? We've had a number of people recently talking about the both the Gabor Mate book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts and the book by Bessel van der Kolk on trauma, and his book is titled The Body Keeps the Score. And one of the similarities between these two books is that the wealth of research that they cite on how trauma actively shapes the development of the human brain when trauma happens to children. And there's a study about ACEs, adverse childhood events, and it's one of the more widely researched or widely quoted studies. And it's kind of mind-boggling at this stage of the game to realize how long people went assuming that whatever happened to kids when they're younger doesn't affect them when they're older. And it's really mind-boggling when you understand that people actually have energetic impressions and downloads that happen in utero. That they have studies about how when parents sing, play music, the father talks through the stomach wall, through the abdomen of the mother, talks to the child on and on, that the rate at which that child recognizes the father's voice immediately after birth is amazing. Clearly, the research they've done on the impact of playing certain types of music to children, reading to children when they're in utero, and the dramatic impact that has on their development. I mean, it's the evidence is overwhelming, it's everywhere to be seen, and it's just incomprehensible to me, for one, that we ever could have thought that this was a time in the development of the person where nothing gets in and nothing affects them, and you don't have to worry about if you have a child who has to go through a surgery. Well, they won't remember it when they're older. That's just absolute baloney. You know, I, as a therapist for 47 years, I can tell you all kinds of people I've dealt with who have trauma still in their system and trauma that affects their development, their interactions with other fellow human beings, decades after this so-called neutral event of having to have surgery as an infant or a toddler. And if that energy system, if the trauma effects aren't addressed, then they continue to impact the person. They continue to be part of a struggle for proficiency. It continues to be the kind of thing that holds people back from achieving in accordance with their skill set, their intellectual capacities, etc. So while not everybody is going to be able to tap into and benefit from those two books because they're quite big and wordy, and they have a lot to do with, they're quite beneficial for practitioners who do therapy with clients. But there's a lot of good material in there about just how negatively trauma and traumatic events impact the actual brain development, the actual physical structures of the brain when we are subjected to trauma as children. And it's completely understandable why some people have significant artistic ability, whether it's in music or art and drawing or sculpting or painting, pottery, and they've demonstrated it at some point in their life. It was clear. They would sit down at the piano and play beautifully, or they would, the first time they got their hands on some modeling clay, they made something that looked like it belonged in a museum. And yet, when they've had a significant amount of trauma in their lives, it's common for them to shut that off, to shut it down, and to be living a life where they're not expressing their creativity. They're not sharing their creativity. And it's all understandable in terms of the trauma. The good news is the more they understand about exactly which brain structures are involved and which mechanisms have been chosen by the person, and chosen is a misnomer, but those patterns that have been developed as a defense against the abuse, the more that's understood, the more it's possible to develop therapies and processes and techniques that can help people resolve the effects of past traumas. And that's what many people like Bessel van der Kolk and Peter Levine and many others that study trauma, people like Dr. Pat Ogden that created the Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, they're geared towards making a difference by developing actual tools to help people resolve the effects of past trauma and be able to move forward in their life with greater freedom and flexibility and greater access to their intelligence, their emotional intelligence, their intellectual intelligence, and their creativity. Peter Levine has a number of books. One of them is Waking the Tiger. It contains actual exercises for helping people reconnect to the physical, sensual, emotional centers in their energy system. He also has a more recent book titled In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Heals and Returns to Goodness. As I've mentioned, and we talked about to some degree a while ago, Gabor Mate has the book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, where he's written extensively about his years of working in one of the most challenging environments in all of Canada, and working with drug addicts and homeless people and learning to treat them with respect, independent of the actuality that they're caught in an abusive pattern. They're caught in physical abuse, sexual abuse, drug and alcohol abuse, verbal and emotional abuse. And, you know, he's developed a system that minimizes the harm. And some people don't like that. Some people say, how can you work with these people when they're still abusing the drugs or themselves or other people? And what they found was that, you know what, it doesn't really do the majority of people any good to say, in order for you to get help for your abuse problems, your traumas, your mental and emotional, your physical sexual abuse, in order for you to get help with that, first you got to quit abusing the drugs or the substance. And because when you do that, you end up just pushing people away from the sense of community, the skilled help, the tools that might eventually help them someday if they reach the point where they're actually willing to pick them up and apply them in their lives. But that possibility gets taken off the table if you begin with, okay, in order for you to get access to us, you have to quit doing everything that's creating your upset. Because quite literally, they're not able to do that. And quite literally, as the book points out in the research that Gabor Mate cites in that book, their brains simply aren't capable of functioning at the level that some people want to hold them accountable for functioning at. And it's understandable in terms of the level of abuse they had in childhood and the way it's impacted their brain development. So, what's on your mind today? How can we support you? We've got about 26 minutes left. 563-999-3581. Do you have a question about the worksheet I did on Wednesday? Do you have a question about what a worksheet is? There's no question to basic and no question to advanced. Some people think they have a very advanced question, and most often it comes right back to the basics. So I will be brave and say we'll handle whatever question you have. 563-999-3581. We are in the 11th month of our 11th year of doing this internet show. So anything you might have heard in the intervening years since you first tuned in, whether that was yesterday or today or 10 and a half or 11 years ago, that topic is open for discussion. What would serve you to discuss today? 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1 and let me know what's on your mind. How can we support you? Quite a few callers on the line. Plenty of time for a conversation. Nobody in the chat room except me. And help us find a direction. What would benefit you to have us talk about? I've had a number of people over the years talk to me about when they do research, they find that the success rate for different treatments for alcoholism, say AA, different 28-day rehab programs, et cetera, that the actual success rate is quite low. And so then they recommend that you do something else. And there are all kinds of people who have a something else kind of thing going on. There's SMART recovery. You might have heard about SMART recovery. There's rational recovery. There's some programs from other countries that say we have a much better success rate. But you can look into Smart Recovery at smartrecovery.org. And it talks about being an international nonprofit organization that provides assistance to individuals seeking abstinence from addiction. The SMART acronym stands for Self-Management and Recovery Training. There are also people that advertise that they've got a better system. There's a James Swanwick who has a program, and he'll send you the e-book for free, and then immediately they'll start offering you coaching sessions that you can pay for. There's rational recovery. And on a regular basis, when I used to do more Sunday church talks at Unity churches and Unitarian Universalist churches and religious science churches, and I used to attend at Christian Science churches, I didn't give talks there. They don't really have outside people give talks. But at all the four or five different churches that I used to attend, if people would hear me talk, they would routinely come up after the talk and say, wow, you spent a lot of time in the rooms. You've spent a lot of time in AA. You've spent a lot of time in rational recovery. And I have to tell them honestly, no, that's not the case. The case is that the truth is just the truth. And there's a lot of good material in any substantial program that's been around for any length of time. And it might be dressed in a slightly different jargon. It might have slightly different acronyms and different metaphors. And yet what works is just like everything else that works. When we come to understand that we are the creator of our experience, and careful here, we're not the creator of everything that happens around us, but we are the creator of how we experience that. We are the creator of our interpretation and response to life events. I had a person in my office earlier today, and she was talking about how intensely the programming of her childhood has set her up to judge herself as less than, and other people as smarter than. And that creates a very powerful experience for her. And as she's been working in therapy, and she's been doing some of the goal canceling, and some EFT tapping, and some take that breath and step back before responding, she's watching herself develop entirely different patterns of response than she's ever had before in her life. She's creating a very different experience in her life, despite the fact that the same people are around doing the same knee-jerk, nasty, insulting, aggressive, ignoring kinds of behaviors. She used to look at those behaviors and use them as something in this blank screen to project her interpretation on, to justify her rage or her attack or her isolating from that person. And she's recognizing more and more as she does this kind of work that she's stepping back from that pattern, catching the earlier warning sign that she's triggered to some kind of an upset, taking that breath that holds at the top and slows the exhale so that it gives her that moment to recognize, oh my gosh, I'm about to rage at this person. Oh my gosh, I'm about to lock horns with another bull moose. And if our horns get locked, we're going to get trapped here in this deathlock, and both of us could die. Both of us are going to get wounded if I blast them with anger in response to their blasting me with anger. And I don't want to do that anymore. And she's noticing that she can shift the way her mind forms pictures and interpretations about these people and their angry or rude or incomplete response. And in that moment, in that, sometimes it's little more than a breath, the beat of a heart. In that moment, with that strong beat and a pause, she starts to see entirely different ways to interpret the life events that she used to use as an excuse for raging. And you can too. That's the point of this work. The more I can live my life from observation, the more I can slow down and observe before acting, the better my life can get, the better choices I can make about how to interpret and respond to the life events that unfold around me. Again, I don't get a chance to create everything that happens in the world around me. And at the same time that's true, I do have the opportunity to create, I do actually play a role in creating everything about how I experience the world as it's unfolding. The interpretation that I choose and place on an event is that thing that gets it either contains a thought pattern that I pour my mind energy into that generates the negative emotion I experience, or it is the same resonant frequency, it's got the same energy pattern to it as some negative emotional state I experienced in the past, and I've downloaded and I'm carrying it with me into this life situation. That's how I end up creating the emotions I experience. I either pour my mind energy into a thought pattern right now today that I have chosen as a way to explain what's just unfolded in front of me, as a way to interpret what's unfolding in front of me. And I pour my mind energy into that thought pattern, and that generates the emotion I experience. Or I choose an interpretation for a neutral life event as it unfolds in front of me that has the same vibrational frequency as trauma energy that I have stored in me. And as I choose that energy, I resonate the trauma energy and I re-experience life the way I have many, many, many times in the past. There's a specific tool available on whyagain.org for that. It's called The Three Early Memories of Conflict. And it's one of the more powerful. It's one of the top three or four of the many different tools that Michael and Jeannie offer. I'll say it again. I recommend that people routinely, you know, once every 6 months or so, if you're new to this, once a month, go and fill out that Three Early Memories of Conflict tool and step through the use of it the way it would be recommended in the instructions for that tool on whyagain.org, and watch the magic. Watch what you can learn about your kind of brainwashing, you're walking through the world as an automaton, you're living the same pattern in your life over and over and over again. Some patterns that every one of us has downloaded in our first 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, depending upon the research that you like to quote, that pattern becomes something that we replay over and over and over again every time it's resonated. That's a very constricting, a very limiting part of being human. And if I don't become aware of it, I can't change it. And the three early memories of conflict tool is it's a powerhouse tool. It's like a bulldozer to remove a driveway. It is a specific tool that can shine the light for me on how I'm not really interacting with people as a competent adult whenever I'm triggered to think of a situation as being conflictual or, you know, confrontational. All I'm doing is replaying what I learned and downloaded in the first 5 or 6 or 7 years of life. And if I become aware of that as an adult, and especially if I have some of the other tools that Michael and Jeannie make available, I can actually make some quick, effective, efficient progress at undoing that pattern. I can step into a level of liberty and an ability to respond differently the next time that a conflictual situation or a confrontational situation develops in my life, or I interpret a situation as being conflictual or confrontational. But if I don't understand what I've brought with me into this situation and all of the different ways that I have replayed it over and over through the years, if I don't understand that, I don't have the option to change. I can't fix a problem that I don't know exists. So, what's a problem you've got? What's one of the struggles you're having in life? Let us help you out by recommending a specific tool and how to apply it. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can get a conversation started. We've got about 10 minutes left, easily. And then Michael and Jeannie should be here for the second hour of the show. So how can we support you today? 563-999-3581. I will I'll be running a show on Tuesday because I'll be doing another interview. I'll be running the audio from the interview with Dr. Richard Moss this next Tuesday. And I'll be leaving the show today on time or a little early and going and doing another interview with another holistic practitioner. So area code 808, you're in the air. Is this Roma?
Yeah, it is. And, I have a pattern which... I was the youngest of 3 children, so that meant that everybody in my household had more power than me. And so I definitely learned how to support everybody. And in that process, very often what was left out was my own autonomy, my own opinion, my own reality. It was like a pattern of abdicating my reality for that of others. And, as an adult, I worked for many years to reclaim that, and it was difficult. I had to face anger and frustration. I had faced a lot of emotion. So I think people who have known me for a while might be surprised that I perceive myself this way, because I sometimes come off as kind of loud and opinionated, I think. But that was part of the healing, development of the healing of that experience of feeling so muted in the face of all the dominant energies around me. So that is the pattern that I'm looking at.
Are you saying that you discovered this pattern by using the three early memories of conflict tool?
No. I agree that's one of the very best tools that Michael... I'm very aware of it now, because my older sister, who hated my guts for like 40 or 50 years, she's gotten so old now, she's 84 years old, and she's forgotten that she hated me. She's literally forgotten that she hated me, and she's reverted to a kind of fundamental love that she and I had as sisters, and we've had phone calls, and every now and then she gets enraged. She'll get triggered, and the last one was she got me confused with a caregiver for her baby child. She had a memory of coming home to her caregiver and her baby, and she came home one day and heard the caregiver say, "Bah, bah, 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 stupid," calling her child stupid. And somehow, because I was always the villain in her life, she sort of framed me as the person who was the villain. She remembers the situation where I never even babysat for her child. I was in Indonesia on cruise ships when her child was at that stage. So, yeah, that just recently came up in our interaction. So that's what triggered it, not the five early conflicts, or not the three early conflicts. But offer.
Are you there, Roma?
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah,
I'm just waiting.
You dropped out.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
yeah, well
that's what
I,
you have to offer. I'm glad that at least at this stage of your life with your sister, it's less contentious and more loving.
Yeah, me too. It's a miracle. It was a complete miracle. But every now and then, the miracle turns to hell again. This is about the third time this has happened since she started wanting to connect with me by phone, and it's profoundly upsetting for me. I mean, it grieves me deeply. Oh gosh.
Well, good thing we have all these tools to help dismantle that upset.
Underneath the grief, I did a worksheet on this yesterday, and underneath the grief, I found anger in me that I get treated this way. I mean, it makes me angry. I get angry, but I've been in denial about my anger. She was my mother, and I saw her as the problem. So she felt that my mother and I were the enemy. Oh gosh! And of course, my mother's dead now.
Okay, and of course. It doesn't make you angry, but you can generate quite a bit of anger when you are in those situations if you interpret them a certain way. And
well,
that's
I
just
don't
the way we
usually
talk about it in this work as a way to help people understand that the tools that Michael and Jeannie offer are actually available to change the constructs that we use to create our own emotions. So we don't,
well, what I started the worksheet out with yesterday was pain, hurt, pain, hurt, pain and hurt. But when I did the worksheet, the layer, the fine layer of the film of hidden emotions came up, and I found the anger that I felt, because I had never been aware of it before. I had certainly never acted on it. And I had never been, I hadn't even been aware that I was angry. So the anger was like a big revelation for me yesterday.
All right. Well, revelation.
Slightly different than what you were assuming, I think, a moment ago. So
I have no idea what I was assuming, but I was just referring
I think you were assuming that I've
pattern.
Been angry, consciously angry about the situation for years.
I wasn't talking about your anger. I was talking about the words you used to say that it was upsetting, and I was just trying to help clarify for the audience
right.
that when we speak that way, we like to clear it up and get to more
yeah.
accurate speech yeah. that describes,
Jack,
I create my own anger. I create
right.
my own sadness, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, I was just responding to your invitation to people to call in if they had an issue.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you. It's nice to hear from you, and I'm glad that you're at least for certain periods of time in your interaction with your sister, having more of a loving experience.
Yeah, all right. I'm so frightened of calling her back and saying, Joanne, I think you got me confused with one of your caregivers. Because when she said the last time we talked, when she said that I had called my little nephew stupid, I've lost my memory to the degree that I said, well, Joanne, if I said that, I'm terribly sorry. But I realized when I got off the phone that I never said that and that she had me confused with one of her hired caregivers. But I haven't had that conversation with her yet. And I have so much fear. I have so much fear about trying to have that conversation.
Okay, it's a good thing
that
you've got the tools.
About.
The reality management worksheet would be a good one. Put
yeah.
that word fear on there and step
that's,
through
that's
the worksheet
exactly
a few
times.
That's
exactly what I did yesterday, and that's when I saw the veil come off the anger. But I guess I'd just keep doing it on fear.
That would be good.
Keep fear and pain. It's fear and pain. Oh.
And as you do that, it would be good
yeah.
to soften and breathe even as you're crying so that the energy doesn't get trapped in your system and you don't keep replaying the negative thoughts.
As soon as I soften my physiognomy, the emotion disappears completely. That's what happens to me. Doesn't it happen with other people too or not?
No. Oh, no.
As a
matter of fact, some people feel it more intensely when they slow down and breathe, and then they keep the energy moving so it can actually move through them.
Yeah.
So
I guess that's one thing.
I thank you for the call. We've run out of the time for my first hour. You can certainly stay on and chat with Michael and Jeannie, but I appreciate the call, and I will mute you so we can do the transfer of switchboarding. And I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I hope you have a good next interview.
Thank you. It's coming up here in about a minute and a half, so I will wish you have a great show, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay, have a good weekend. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Friday, November the 19th, 2021, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And while we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in, I'll share a dream that I had. I told Michael, I said it was different from any dream that I've ever had. And we were all at like a timeshare place. It was like a house. And there was just lots of people there. And there outside the front door, there was a tree. And hanging from the limb of a tree was a basket that said, newsboy or newspaper boy or something like that. And inside of it was a loaf of bread wrapped up and a newspaper. And it had a phone number on it. And you called the phone number and there was a person, and in this case it was a man, that just showed up. And just spent time with the person who called the number and just listened to them, talked to them, was just company for them, and gave them some little gifts or whatever, and just held the space for whoever it was, you know. And I thought, wow, that is actually a really good idea to have a number where people can call and just have somebody to be there for them. And actually, that's what this radio show is. You know, you call in, you press one, you have concerns or questions or need help with a worksheet or just to talk. And we are here holding the space for that. But you have to dial the number and you have to press one. And so we are here to support you. You're not alone. Welcome, Michael.
As you complete that that sentence, Jeannie, you remind me of the awesome America's Got Talent song that was sung by actually an Irish priest on AGT, and the last line of the song is, "You are not alone." Powerful. And the title of the song that he sang, what was the title of that song? If you Google it, if you want to give it a listen, he's just, his voice is so awesome. His name's Father Ray Kelly. And he speaks from the perspective, he sings a song from the perspective of someone who's basically there as a listening ear. And as that listening ear, he puts his song forward to people on, you know, hold to knowing that you're not alone. Anyway, it's powerful. And you know, when you shared that dream with me this morning, what was clear to me is that your mind is telling you that you've reached a whole new level in your process of being that space, of holding that space, of being that that energetic presence in the world. So that's pretty sweet. Pretty powerful.
Yeah, thank you.
I get to be blessed if you're doing that for me every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sweet. So there's another piece, and I'm just looking in my phone for it, that I came across this morning that I thought was pretty cool. And, you know, the thing that really motivated me, my son's now 42, I guess. Yeah, 42. So it's 42 years ago. And I was doing this work. And back then, nobody got into my workshops without money. It was all about the money. You know, I'd come from the business world, and I'd given up a fairly lucrative business to step into teaching. And then when my son was born, I stood there. I can remember, you know, I got to catch him. We birthed him at home. And I got to catch him coming out of the womb and hold him and marveling at that presence of love and thinking about his future. And I can remember so clearly thinking, if somebody doesn't do something about the way the world is going, then just think it'll be a place for this kid to grow up. And quite literally, this body of work is what I've done about it from where I sit. And it wasn't long after that that I made the shift out of charging for every workshop that I did to where it was, you know, if you're not familiar with the model that we've used, basically for 40 years now, I've traveled. We're not traveling anymore, but traveled, and you know, we paid our own expenses, and we did our workshops free. And a lot of people puzzled, looked in a very puzzling way at me when I would say, "Well, that's what we do." Well, no, you. I mean, we even had churches say, "No, no, you've got to charge money." It's like, well, if we have to charge money to come and speak at your church, so that you can make money, so that we can make money, then we're not coming. We're going to do it free. There'll be money to be made, you know, there'll be support, because at the end of each workshop, we would let people know the reason it's free is we're committed to giving it away, whether you have money or not, it's irrelevant. And if you've got money or you've got a talent that you can offer in support of this work, if it's benefited you, then support us with a donation. And, you know, for 40 years, that's what got this work traveling all over the globe. now that we're settled in here taking care of Jean's dad and a new grandchild who's been circling there for 3 years and is here at least 3 days a week, we've gotten rid of our travel plans and we're moving into a different way of expressing. But our commitment is still to make it available. And, you know, and we make it available in both directions. We're not out there in front of people the way we used to be and say, okay, at the end of the workshop, you know, if you want to donate, we pass the basket. We don't have the way to do that. The radio show is kind of a similar thing. If it's benefiting you, please, you know, jump on the website and offer a gift. But I came across a piece that the author is unknown, but here's his writing. It's titled Growing Good Corn.
Michael, before you continue, move your microphone a little because it's breathy, and that
okay.
way they'll be able to
okay.
hear what you read really clear.
All right. Is that better?
Yes.
Good. Okay. There was once a farmer who grew award-winning corn. Each year he entered his corn into the state fair where it won a blue ribbon. One year, a newspaper reporter interviewed him and learned something interesting about how he grew it. The reporter discovered that the farmer shared his seed corn with his neighbors. How can you afford to share your best corn seed with your neighbors when they're entering the corn competition with yours each year? The reporter asked. Why, sir, said the farmer, didn't you know? The wind picks up pollen from the ripening corn and swirls it from field to field. If my neighbors grow inferior corn, pollination will steadily degrade the quality of my corn. If I'm going to grow good corn, I must help my neighbors to grow good corn. He was very much aware of the connectedness of his life. His corn cannot improve unless his neighbor's corn also improves. So it is with our lives. Those who choose to live in serenity must help their neighbors to live in serenity. Those who choose to live well must help others to live well. For the value of life is measured by the lives it touches. And those who choose to be happy must help others to find happiness. For the welfare of each is bound up with the welfare of all. Is it possible, the writer says, to give away and become richer? Is it also possible to hold on too tightly and lose everything? Yes, a liberal man shall be rich. By watering others, he waters himself, says Proverbs 11:24-25. So I came across that this morning, and it kind of fits very well, sweetie, with your dream. And this, the idea without recompense, without turning it into commercial business. You know, there's an interesting line in the movie, if you haven't watched it, Gods and Generals. It was made by Turner Broadcasting, and I understand that Ted Turner was a very, you know, strong advocate for accuracy in Civil War, you know, documentaries and such. And it's interesting, there's one scene in the film where, and I'm not sure, it's been several years since I saw the film, I saw it when it first came out. But there's one scene where I think it's Jackson talking to Lee or Lee talking to Jackson or someone along those lines. And what he says is, if we lose this war, commerce and the bankers are going to take over our country. And if you take a look, you know, who gets to be president? What are most of the conversations about around president? Commerce. Making a buck rather than about human lives. And because commerce is involved in the game, commerce tends to support whatever increases what's in the hands of those who are in that commercial business. And everyone else tends to go down. If you look at our culture, you know, it's really a conversation about rich and poor, the haves and the have-nots. I was reading yesterday that the stimulus that went out, which many people have complained about, raised more children out of poverty, like over a million children through that time with all this COVID stuff and all going, over a million children were raised out of poverty, more than at any time since they've been tracking poverty levels of families and children. And yet commerce says, oh, that's going to cost us too much money. But, oh, by the way, give us another piece of land on which we can drill and make billions. Commerce tends to be greedy. And if we've been taught greed, then we'll tend to create the kinds of separations that we're seeing exacerbated in our culture. And maybe it's time to, if, you know, if one's found themselves in that posture, to start looking at a technology, and that's the whole idea of this technology, a technology that brings us back to our humanness, brings us back to functioning out of a mind that functions, that behaves, that advocates for that which is based in love. You know, it's interesting, in one of the Beatitudes, it says, and, you know, generally speaking, when the Greeks translated the first idea in the Beatitudes, it says, blessed are they, in Aramaic, nothing about blessing anything or anybody. In Aramaic, the word is tuvehun, it's a three-part word. And basically what tuvehun means, so before each of the Beatitudes, it doesn't say blessed are they, blessed are they, blessed are they, blessed are they. It says, elate, and of course, when this happens, one would be blessed. But it misses out on the point. A latent neural structure, latent being something unconscious, implanted by the Creator to guide us to happiness and well-being, become our conscious possession. Yoo-hoo. What the Beatitudes, what Yeshua was saying 2,000 years ago, is that inside of each of us there is a guidance system, and it's designed to take us to our highest state of well-being and happiness. And if we lost ourselves in commercial interest, if we've lost ourselves in hostility and fear and greed and rage and separation and drama and trauma and divorce and hate, if we've lost ourselves in that, then that neural structure, literally that instruction set that's in the mind of every person, has been subverted. And so when you read the Beatitudes properly from the Aramaic, what you see is, here's a set of instructions for activating this neural structure that's designed to guide you to happiness and well-being, not designed to make you more money, not designed to give you more power or more political clout or more any of that stuff. It's designed to support the truth of who you are. In one of those Beatitudes, properly translated, says, a latent neural structure implanted by the Creator to guide you to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession. You who engage in just and fair behavior between people. Just and fair behavior was the key. And sadly, when greed and the root thought disorders that in this particular culture I would offer, I observe taking humanity out of their humanness, are based in greed. Are based in there's not enough, and therefore I have to get more. And no matter how much more, there has to be more. As opposed to the guiding principle of the mind, the guardrails on the highway to reason being those of just and fair behavior between people. If you want to check out the Beatitudes a little further, you can go to our website, whyagain.org, and under, if you click on the link in the upper left-hand corner that says Start Here, that link will walk you all the way through to a place where you'll see all the different worksheets and posters that we have. And one of the posters is the Beatitudes poster. You might want to give that a look. And/or we've got the poster printed on a nice piece of parchment. It's in two colors. It's red and blue. It's kind of a nice, it's like a standard 10 by 13 frame size. You can order it, I don't know, they're a couple dollars, something like that, on our website. But you can just print it off as well. But when you realize what was understood about the guardrails for keeping the human mind on track, it's so profound and so powerful in supporting us in returning to real, true human life, really moving into what we are as human beings. And, you know, our chapter in our book that we've been working on, we just started yesterday into, or the day before, into chapter 22, What is Learning? We're talking about building brain cells with this character, Richard, in the book. If you're following along, we're on page 147. And so we're offering that there are ways to understand and keep your mind in harmony. And if you've been brought up in a world that's based in greed, hostility, and fear, then it's going to be a major learning process, especially if you come from many generations of that, which is kind of what this seems to be running the world pretty much, then it's going to take time to build the brain cells and turn the ship of behavior around into something that's really in harmony with human life. And so I just offered this thought to Richard that, you know, you sit in front of a computer, Richard, for the first time, and do you even know how to turn it on? And when you turn it on, do you even know what a C prompt means? When you know what a C prompt means, do you know how to get to a program? You know, what? How much do you know about it? And it's like, well, nothing really when I started. So now I have to build brain cells. And if you remember, you know, I can think back to the early days of working on computers, and now I can do most anything I need to do on a computer, although once in a while I have to turn to Jeannie because she's got the brain cells built on a whole other level for operating computers than I do. Thank you, Jeannie. But I can remember back in the early days, and you know, you might just think about it using this as a metaphor. How many hours has it taken you to get to the skill level where you can use your computer the way you use it? Now, the kinds of things that I do, Jeannie does, if I went back and I tried to do a record of it, I'd be up in the many thousands of hours. And it's interesting that we'll invest that kind of time in something like using a tool that's outside of us, but we won't invest that kind of time, or many people won't invest that kind of time, into learning how to restructure and use their own minds. And our invitation is to stick around long enough and to take the time to build the brain cells to move into a totally different world. So Richard responds to this idea of the computer metaphor. So setting computer to work takes learning. Or pardon me, getting the computer to work takes learning. Is that what you're you call building brain cells, Richard interjected. Yes. And in life, we live out of the realities for which we have brain cells. Life does not punish. It only gives back what we ask for. Now, it's kind of fun, you know, many of you are aware that one of the things that Jeannie and I do is we are film buffs. So movies are oftentimes our intermission. And back several weeks ago, we came across a new series a couple months ago on Netflix. And some of it's pretty coarse and gross in its sexual references. It's kind of an interesting series. It's called Lucifer. And basically, Lucifer, the devil, quote-unquote, decides he's going to take a vacation from hell, and he goes to Los Angeles. And it's really quite an interesting setup, the way they've structured it. And he ends up meeting a young woman who's a detective, and reluctantly moving out of his old patterns of using people and, you know, all the stuff that he does to caring for someone. So we're in what I think about the fourth season of Lucifer. And there have been two interesting portrayals, so powerfully on track with the work. You know, they go back and forth, you know, show after show, and they have conflicts, and they make up, and, you know, they're not in relationship, but he becomes her partner. He becomes, Satan becomes an advisor. Pardon me, they don't refer to him as Satan. They refer to him as the devil. The devil becomes an advisor to the Los Angeles Police Department, and they solve all kinds of cases together. But all the personal conflicts are gone. And he's starting to grapple with, you know, because he's, you know, he's the classic, everything in his life is everybody else's fault. He's got somebody to blame for everything. And the main one he blames is his father. So there are lots of conversations about dad, and his brother comes to Earth, who's another angel. And, you know, they're always talking about dad and how controlling dad is, and mom. And, you know, it's humorous, yet there's a thread of such deep truth in it. And we're just at the stage where he's starting to confront himself, and he comes to the conclusion of, my God, here I have been blaming everybody else, and it's me. It's all about me. He has this realization. It's not everybody else. And then he's got a therapist. So he goes in and sits with the therapist. And he finally comes to the conclusion of, you know, and says it with quite a great deal of emphasis, why do I hate myself so much? So he starts to deal with his self-hatred. And there's a byline or a sideline where there's a prophecy that, you know, when he comes back to the earth and meets his first love, that evil will be released upon the earth, unleashed. And so there's, you know, a lot of back and forth about that. And he's like, he's going to stop it. No, I don't want that. I care. You know, I care about these humans. I don't want that to happen. I mean, yeah, my job has been punishing those who do wrong. And there's a lot of talk about punishment throughout it. But he wants to stop it. And there's a thing that happens. He looks like a normal human being, but when he gets really upset, he goes into what he calls his devil face, and his eyes turn red, and, you know, he becomes the personification of the devil. And so this prophecy is enacted. It's triggered into activity, and what it does, like, he can normally just turn on and turn off this quote-unquote devil face, where, I mean, he looks pretty gross in the red eyes. He can turn them on and off. But as the interaction with his first love, and I won't give it away telling what that's part of the story is if you choose to watch it, but he's so enmeshed with her that he can't pull away. And so this starts to create a transformation in his body. I mean, it is so on track with the cause of disease. And his face, when he puts on this devil face, his face turns red and it's, you know, knobby and gnarly and distorted. Well, his body starts to make that kind of transformation. It just starts on the back of his hand, and then it moves from his hand to his arm and ultimately takes over his whole body. And there he is. He can't get back to the human appearance, but his physiology is this very gross-looking devil with the wings that have horns on it and all of that, you know, kind of like the old icons on European buildings. In any event, he's like, oh my God, you know, I can't change this. I'm lost. It's done. I can't do anything about it. And this woman that he's been attracted to, they end up talking about it, and she believes him. She knows who he is. She's seen him as the devil understands, but she sees the good in him. The upshot, the visual of it was just so profoundly on track with exactly what happens to our so-called physical bodies, because he goes through this metamorphosis where he cannot return to his normal, you know, attractive young man physical form. He's grossly transformed physiologically into this devil figure. And, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, this evil is going to be unleashed on the whole world because of him. And he's like, oh, repentance. He's like, no, 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 I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. And he's talking to her, and he's like, there's nothing I can do. I'm just going to have to, you know, go back to hell. You know, he's come on vacation, and he's now years later, and he's like, I'm not going back there. But he comes to the conclusion that in order to save humanity, he's got to go back to hell. And she's with him, and she's like, no, but you can't go, and, you know, we can change this. He says, but I have so much self-hatred. And I want to forgive myself, but I don't know how. Of course, he's using forgiveness in the way the culture uses it. But it's interesting. I want to, but I don't know how. And the moment he speaks of wanting to, he starts to metamorphize back into his human, attractive young man physical form, and his disease literally evaporates. And the interesting thing, and I would love to know who wrote the script and who put this together, because it is profoundly powerful, was just, I mean, literally to time in this film this metamorphosis from full-blown gross-looking devil form into an attractive young man again. Literally begins the instant he expresses his willingness. He brings up forgiveness. He says, I want to forgive. I don't know how. I want to. And literally the minute he expresses that willingness, a transformation begins. And I'm telling this story because that's exactly how it works. You know, as long as I'm in the belief about my hate and my fear, and I've always got an attack and a story for everybody, and, well, you know, whatever. Now I can say, oh, I'd like to change that. I don't like that about me. But that isn't the willingness that comes from, I really, truly realize to change, and I'm willing to go there. And that when one steps into that willingness, there is an uplifting flow and an uplifting force within us that is activated by that willingness. In the first century Aramaic language, it's called Ruka Dekudsha. Those words by the Greeks were translated as the Holy Spirit. There's nothing about a disembodied spirit being in the words Ruka Dekudsha, but it speaks of an actual literal elemental force that exists in us that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. And it's the invitation. Not the flippant, oh, yeah, well, I'll turn it over to the Holy Spirit, to Ruka Dekudsha, but a real true willingness and clearly framing in the mind and setting a goal to move to a different place in one's life than generations of history would dictate one must live. Most people are so engrossed in what they've learned in the brain cells from the past that they can't lift their eyes from their pain and their trauma and their turmoil, especially when they've been triggered by some event in their lives. And for me, this film just so powerfully portrayed that the instant he went into a sincere willingness, there was support, assistance, and transformation. Doesn't mean you have to know it all.
And can I ask?
Jeannie? Please.
And
yes,
she was
absolutely
holding love. Like,
oh, yeah.
While he was in process, she was just standing there being the space of love, regardless of how ugly he looked. And
yeah, previously
and then
she turned
another,
away from him because he was so gross looking. But yeah, that's so profoundly part of the puzzle, Jean. Your dream.
Yeah, and there was another part in, not at that part, but at another time, he had expressed that hell didn't have locked doors, but that everybody was locked into their own guilt and blame and punishment for themselves in an eternal loop. They just would keep repeating it over and over again. The why is this happening to me again?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's a lot of very powerful principles. Yeah. Yeah, actually, several times through the film, they show different people and how they're stuck in this. They call it a hell loop. Well, it's your own. And in fact, earlier in the film, there's another level of it where he himself, you know, Lucifer, acknowledges that he has his own hell loop. It's like, oh, my God, I'm doing this to myself. It isn't them. And he teaches others, you know, you're doing this to yourself. Well, yeah, you've got all this cooperation, all these people that seem to be doing it to you, but the truth is you're doing it to yourself. And he realizes that for himself. So it's going to be interesting to see where they go from here. We're in season 4, and they've got 6 seasons, so it'll be interesting to see what unfolds, because this is certainly a climax point in it for, and we just watched that last night where he just so deep is so deeply moved by the suffering of humanity that he's been a part of that he wants to change it all. And what he comes back to and down to is he realizes and demonstrates very overtly that he needs to change himself. And yeah, you're so right, Jean, where previously she had trouble holding the space and she actually separates from him for a time period to do some work and come back to where she can hold the space. And then you can see her just standing there as that sweet presence of love as he's going through this. Oh my, I don't know how to forgive. And she is as gross as he looks. She's just embracing him fully in present love. It's just, it's really profoundly powerful and a great demonstration. Like, it's probably been, what, Jeannie, 2 seasons since she found out. I mean, in the beginning, season 1, he tells her, oh, I'm the devil. And it's like, ha-ha, yeah, right, okay. Well, you've got this metaphor for your life, you're evil and blah, blah, blah. But then about the beginning of season 3, he shows her he actually is the devil. He does this whole devil transformation phase and such. And she is just so blown away she can't handle it. And it shows her processing. And then she gets to the point where for this ultimate presence of ugly and evil, she's the space. She literally is. There's nothing in her to be resonated by his ugly appearance and evil eminence. I'm not even sure how to say it, but just that she's not impacted by it anymore. She's done her work and she's clean and clear and is the space of active present love. Pretty powerful metaphor, pretty powerful to look at. And, you know, again, I'd love to know who put this together to, you know, to, that had the brain cells to understand things, healing at this level. It's pretty awesome. So if you've got Netflix and you get a chance, give a look at the TV series Lucifer. Any other thoughts for you on that, Jeannie? Because you're right. I mean, I wasn't thinking in those terms, but she just so profoundly is the space.
Yeah. That's all I can think of right now. Mm-hmm. Something, though, you said triggered, you know, we played a replay yesterday, but day before that, there was conversation with a couple of different people about getting past what they've learned. And you said something earlier about, you know, people, you know, learning to be a certain way and you know, not getting past that. And it made me think of when I went back to college, one of my psych papers that I wrote was about learned helplessness. And one of the things I think for people to get past and to be willing to make a change is to look at what they've learned and that it's not right, or it's, you know, that there's something different. The examples that I used in my paper were had to do with dogs, but it's the same thing with humans. One example was they put these dogs, and this is cruel, but they did an experiment, and they put these dogs in a cage or a box or something, and they would shock them. And at first, of course, the dog would, you know, jump and howl and try to get away, and when it realized it couldn't, then it just became very passive to the abuse and just, you know, laid down and took it, and it didn't try to fight it. And then another example was this dog, you know, it knew that when it needed to go outside, the owner had to open both the big wooden door and then the screen door for it to go out. And it had, you know, that's how it was all the time. Well, something happened and the screen door got messed up, so it was just the frame. And they would open the hardwood door and the dog would just stand there. Now, it could have just stepped right through. I mean, they even showed it. You can step through this door. It doesn't have to be open. And the dog had been trained so much that that door had to be open. They could open the frame and then the dog would go out. But just, you know, it had learned that it couldn't go through that door. And people do the same thing. You know, like I got married at the age of 16 and I stayed in an abusive situation for 3 years and I kind of got like that dog. You know, at first I would fight it and then after a while just passively accepted the abuse. And that people get to, you know, they look at their situation that it's helpless and they can't do anything about it. And so they just accept the way things are and don't try to change. And don't try to see that what they've learned is not necessarily accurate and that they can step through the door. They can, you know, do something different. And so that kind of came to me when I don't even remember now who it was we were talking to day before yesterday. But that is definitely a real thing, that we learn helplessness and we have to unlearn that. We have to be willing to do something different.
And that's why the use of the tools is so important. It's like the forgiveness process is the unlearning. And, you know, if it were simply a matter of building new brain cells for something new, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But if you've got a mind that thinks it already knows, you know, if that mind isn't willing to look at the truth, if that mind isn't willing to receive feedback and look honestly, and you can always tell when the mind is lying to itself and not being honest. And here's how you tell. If a new piece of information shows up, that mind goes into stress and they attack the source of the information. Rather than taking a breath and going, I never looked at that that way. If up comes the ugly, you know, attack and viciousness, put down of the, you know, remember when one lives in blockage of truth and truth shows up, when truth is shown to a mind that's in blockage of truth, the stress level goes up in that mind. When the stress level goes up, it's attached to one of two things. It's either attached to getting rid of the information that shows it the blockage, you know, that's the John the Baptist syndrome, You know, John the Baptist delivered information to the king and queen they didn't want to hear, and what did? They took off his head. So their stress was attached to getting rid of the source of the information. You know, I like to kind of tongue-in-cheek offer that there were two, and if you decide to play John the Baptist for somebody, there are two skills you need to develop. One is you need to know when to duck, and the second one is you need to when to hold the mirror up. Because when you're delivering truth to people who are in blockage of truth, depending on their power person issues, depending on how their power person treated them, they can be pretty vile and pretty vicious. And so being willing to receive information instead of turning to a power person dynamic and attacking means that you shift where the stress is attached and now are connected. And when you have that stress go up, you connect it to, oh, I'm in hostility, I'm in rage, I'm in fear, I'm in sadness, whatever it happens to be. Oh, I can go into self-correction. This is something, instead of projecting it into your brain's image of someone else, this is something that I can take responsibility for, and I can do healing of this dynamic in me rather than being subject to this dis-ease. Again, that was the beauty of the visual with this whole thing with Lucifer. You know, I mean, he's transformed into this vile-looking creature, and he expresses with great enthusiasm, I want to forgive, I don't know how, and bingo, his transformation starts to happen. Total, like within minutes, total physical transformation. And so it is with the healing of our so-called diseases. So we live out of the realities for which we have brain cells. And oftentimes we think life punishes us, but, you know, if somebody's stuck in a hell loop, it's because they hold a belief that they are supposed to be punished. You know, we've done over the years a lot of work in the prisons, and one of the things we found in interviewing prisoners was that the majority of people in prison felt like they needed to be there in order to be punished for the wrong that they'd done. Now, when you start really looking, punishment never makes people do the right thing. It might, through fear, have them avoid doing, quote-unquote, the wrong. But here's what happens. Because that energy is never addressed, it builds and builds and builds until it breaks through, and it becomes some kind of extreme, oftentimes criminal activity. Once we remove punishment from the equation, and there was a point where, you know, in this Lucifer series where the woman that we're talking about was considering a form of punishment for him because that was his thing. You know, his main thing was that, you know, I'm here to punish those people who've done wrong, and I love my job. She considers that, but she processes through it, moves through her own trauma, her own mind's blockage of truth, and arrives at a space where she can really, truly be that space of love. So the mind is much like life. It doesn't do what you want it to do. It does what you tell it to do. So again, it only gives us what we ask for. If the realities we hold in brain cells call for what looks like punishment, life will be limited to doing just that again and again. Until we change. Just like the computer, when you learn how life works, its creative capacity will open up to you. Developing a deeper comprehension of how we learn and refining our understanding of the difference between reality and actuality will make this work easier to grasp. In the Aramaic culture, the distinction between actuality and reality was well understood. Through the brain, we can only see and grasp a reality that is in our brain cell structure, though we may think we see and understand what is happening in the outside world. There is much more to life than what is seen through our limited senses. And so the idea of taking these tools and correcting the mind so that everything that is held by the mind is accurate and true about actuality, rather than the mind replacing what actually happened with an internally generated reality that distorts the truth of the moment. And hostility and fear, when they move within human physiology, are telling us that if hostility or fear is moving in us, our mind is using corrupt data to build that perceptual construct. And so they are the places when there's corrupt data that forgiveness needs to be applied. You say, well, but did you see what that person did? What they did was really terrible. It's like, you know something? I watched. It was really terrible. I agree 200%. But notice that shy of a punch in the nose, they can't hurt you. But if what they said, quote unquote, in your mind hurts you, if what they did in your mind, quote unquote, hurts you, it's because hurt is the internal energy that you're holding. And hurt can be forgiven. We're not designed for hurt. Hurt is just a signal. It's like the fire alarm. Hurt tells us that we're engaging in an energy that doesn't belong within the structure. Corrupt data, hostility, and fear. And just notice, you know, I mean, it's pretty simple. Have you ever been accused of doing something that you absolutely never did or saying something you absolutely never said? Of course, everybody's been accused of that. Go back to 1, 2, 10, 20, 50 times where that happened and notice that every time the person who was accusing you was in some form of hostility or fear. Now, what does that mean? The person who lives in blocks your people, that means that they're wrong. No, here's what it means. When you're in hostility or fear, your mind is a liar. It is not telling you the truth about anything, yourself or anything that you look at. That's what it means. And so, literally, forgiveness needs to be applied to those energetic patterns inside of us that create hostility or fear so that, those patterns of hostility or fear are removed and we're no longer functioning out of corrupt data. Then we can be in the most disastrous of situations, as, you know, we described in this film or this TV series, and love will be conscious, active, and present in you. It cannot be taken away by the events of the world. It can only be taken away when we enter into denial. What is denial? Denial is the act of thinking or speaking so something outside of us is the cause of what's happening inside of us. When we deny, we have to hide the part of our mind that holds the truth, which means we dissociate from that part of our mind. It means that part of our mind is no longer ours to change. As long as it's in hiding and whenever it is resonated into activity, the mind will lie to us and we'll believe that its lie is the truth because we saw it. We literally, that perceptual construct was a full-blown visual image that showed us what somebody else did to us. And it's a lie. And so it takes great wisdom every time the mind comes up with some form of hostility or fear to choose to enter into forgiveness and look at the root of that experience that corrupted that part of the mind and bring healing to it, bring forgiveness to it. And the willingness to do that is what we're here to support. So once again, there's much more to life than what is seen through our limited senses. And so that's our reading from the chapter, What is Learning? From Why Is This Happening to Me Again? By the way, it's chapter 22, page 148. And if you don't have a copy of the book, we can't sell you a new one because it's out of print. However, you can go to eBay or to Amazon, and there are always copies available used on both of those sites. You know, we're used bookstores all over. So we fortunately got enough copies out there that they're pretty much spread around the country and around the world. So they're still available there. And or you're welcome to go to our website. There are actually two ways you can acquire the book from our website. You can download it free. Again, if you want to free, if you want to pay for it, if you want to support us, then buy it. If you don't want it, then download it free. So you can go and download it in English and German and Spanish and Farsi, and there's some of it in Thai, German, several different languages. And or you can also purchase a recording, an MP3 of actually the latest version of the book. We have not published anything other than the original, published in writing anything other than the original version of the book. But I did a significant amount of editing for actually the version that was printed in Swedish. And unfortunately, we don't have Swedish available on our website because it's the Swedish publisher was concerned that they would lose money if they put it on the website free. So we unfortunately don't have that, but you can download it in many different printed forms, but there is an MP3 recording of that version of the book, the full reading from start to finish. Actually, I play the character or myself in the book, and then a character actor plays the part of Richard and actually plays it very powerfully. So that recording is available in our catalog of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And, gee, we're down to about 10 minutes. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything else happening in the chat room?
We're actually down to 7 minutes. And no, nobody has a hand up. So somebody press one. We have time for a quick question.
Yeah. Or even a slow question. It doesn't matter. A question, slow or quick. It's interesting how invariably the language that most people default to is quick question. Another interesting default that I notice is happening virtually everywhere. I don't care whether you go to the grocery store or the post office or, you know, technical support online, or you're calling into a store online. It's virtually universal. Something I notice has been replaced in, and this can't be an accident. And I wonder it, who's behind it and why. But if you notice that the words thank you in a commercial transaction are virtually non-existent today, you notice that almost universal response is no problem. I mean, I marvel, and I actually stop the mid-sentence oftentimes when I'm on phone with tech support or a problem with a product that we bought, and they'll say, yeah, well, okay, well, we'll just do this and this and this and this, and no problem. I say, excuse me. Yes, this is a problem. We're talking about a problem. Please, let go of this telling me there's no problem. We're talking about a problem. But, you know, it's interesting how language and, you know, how universal that's become. What do you suppose happened to thank you? And I, for one, would like to start a movement where we invite these people, and rather, instead of telling us no problem, to actually express a thank you, which is what, you know, what a previous culture did. So anyway, Jeannie?
Or you're welcome.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no problem. It's just amazing. So if you're out there in listener land, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you in our control panel, you can't talk to us directly, but you can phone into the show at 563-999-3581. 563-999-3581. And if you push 1, if you call that number, you'll be listening to the show on your phone. And if you push 1, the hand will go up and Gene will introduce you by your area code. If you're not using the forgiveness tool as yet, we suggest that you go to our website, whyagain.org. Upper left-hand corner, a link that says start here, walk you through the whole process. Everything we know about it is there, free. There's several different worksheets that go with different workshops. There are several different versions of the main tool of forgiveness that we teach. Acquaint yourself with them. There are at least 20 different radio shows where either Dr. Tim or Jeannie or myself have walked someone through the whole forgiveness process. So there are lots of instructions on the worksheet. You can do the worksheet right there live on the website, on our Why Again website. Or you can go to your phone's app store. And if you type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, one word, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness, you will be looking at the world's only forgiveness app. And you can download that free. It's a very private app. It will only ask you for one permission, and that is for the app to use the internet. It won't ask you if they can dial your phone or send text or take pictures, you know, all that crap that apps ask for. It's only one thing. Once you've done a worksheet in the app will offer the opportunity for you to save it as a PDF, and it will ask for a second permission, and that would be to save the PDF to your storage device, your phone or whatever. Other than that, there are no permissions required. We purposely kept it, you know, realizing that people would do some very private things. We purposely kept the app as private as anyone could possibly have an app. And it's powerful. There are two different versions of the worksheet on it. Jeannie has added the commitment. It has a children's game for introducing kids to the forgiveness process, the Dragon Klingon game. The commitment is now on the app, and we're actually looking at a few other upgrades that we're going to do to it to expand its usefulness. Ultimately, I have a vision that somewhere down the road we'll have all of the tools on the app. We'll have the communication tool, and we'll have access to everything that that we do. But it's a process, and so if there's anything you'd like to do to support us in that process, maybe you've got a skill. I would love to come up with, you know, someone who can do these whiteboard drawings that you see, instructional videos, and take things and put them into instructional form. If anybody happens to have that skill and would like to step up to the plate and assist us in making this available to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. If you speak a language, speak, read, write, translate a language that our book is not translated into, it would be awesome if you chose to step up to the plate and translate the book so it would be available to anyone in the world that speaks the language that you speak if we don't have it translated already. And so if you've got any way you'd like to bring support forward into this work, that would be awesome. And or if there's any way we can support you, that's exactly what we're here to do. And we appreciate you being a part of the show. We hold the space that you have the best year yet of your eternal life. Gracias. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.